The next templestudy.com fireside discussion is kind of what we're calling these, where we get together and talk a little bit about the scholarship pertaining to the LDS Temple, including history, ancient history, all the way up to the present. We're glad to have with us today Gary N. Anderson, who is an attorney from Logan, Utah. Glad to have you, Gary, here with us.
Glad to be back.
And we also have William Hamblin, who is a professor of history at Brigham Young University and is very knowledgeable about the temple, and glad to have him with us as well.
Glad to be here.
One thing I forgot to mention about Gary is that he's one of the organizers of a new Academy for Temple Studies, which will be hosting a symposium or a conference, I guess you could say, in Logan this coming October. October 29th, I believe, is the day. And let me show you just some of the people who will be presenting there. Of course, here's Gary, Daniel Bachman, Margaret Barker, who is well known in LDS circles for her scholarship, Philip Barlow, LeGrand Davies, John L. Fowles, Jonathan Hall, Lawrence Hemming, Frederick Huckel, Daniel C. Peterson, and John W. Welch will be presenting at that that conference in Logan in October. So we're really excited about that and hope a lot of people make it out to Logan for that.
Sounds like a great program.
Yeah, you might want to just tell them if they want to go online to get that site you just talked about. It's just templestudies.org.
Yep, absolutely. Templestudies.org is that website. You can get all the information, all the details, the times, the presenters, what they're presenting on. The phone number to register for that conference is there as well. So, yeah, templestudies.org. If you want to find out more information about that conference.
Great.
So, very good. Well, let's get to it. We're using as our as a springboard for discussion about the temple this book right here. It's called Temple Worship, and there it is. Bill has it as well. Temple Worship by Andrew Skinner, published in 2007. I read it a few years ago, thought it was very good. It covers a lot of aspects about the temple, both ancient and modern, and thought it would be a good way to springboard discussion about the temple, so we don't have to, you know, try to figure out, you know, what we're going to talk about. We can kind of look at this and then discuss some issues and some scholarship and studies that have been done on the temple. And so we'll just jump into the introduction. Last week we talked a little bit about Hugh Nibley and what he talked about the temple, what he wrote about the temple, which was quite a lot. Obviously, he was quite prolific about the temple, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about him in later discussions. But tonight we wanted to jump into one of the things that Andrew Skinner impressed him about the temple was the connections with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he goes into discussing about the Essenes. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
The Essenes community, the Dead Sea Scrolls community that lived in, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Is it Qumran?
Qumran, that's exactly right.
Qumran. Good. So he talks about the Dead Sea Scrolls and how this community, and I certainly am not an expert about the Dead Sea Scrolls. I know a little bit, but I'm really going to lean on you two for your knowledge about the Dead Sea Scrolls, what they mean to us. I know the community of the Essenes, there's lots of similarities between that community and the Latter-day Saints. Maybe we can touch a little bit on that, as well as their their desire to for the temple. The temple seemed to be this central focus of the Qumran community. So maybe we could just talk a little bit about that.
Well, you need to give a little bit of background on what's going on with the Qumran community. And basically, it's related to a crisis in the heir to the high priesthood and the Antiochus III, who was a Greek Seleucid king, Seleucid dynasty of Syria, also attempted to kind of turn the temple into a Hellenistic-style temple. But what happened was the lineage of high priest was supposed to be in the Zadokite family. These are descendants from Zadok, who was the high priest at the time of David and Solomon. He was a descendant of Aaron, and at the time of David and Solomon, essentially the idea arose that only descendants of Zadok could be the high priests. So this continues on for centuries, but then in the when the temple was defiled by Antiochus, the high priesthood was essentially set at abeyance for a few years, and there was a rebellion by a group known as the Maccabees, who were essentially, they were a Jewish Levite family, but were not Zadokites. And so they, in their rebellion, they kicked out the Greeks, set up an independent kingdom, and then set their family up as kings. But they also took the high priesthood. And so the kings at that time were both king and high priest. Now the kings were neither of the house of David, nor were they of the house of Zadok. So many Jews thought, well, these guys have succeeded, therefore they have received a divine approval, and therefore they can, you know, be kings and high priests. But other Jews said, no, these guys have, you know, they had a great rebellion, but they're supposed to turn power back over either to a Davidic family for the kingship or to a Zadokite for the high priesthood. And so there was a schism, and one group of people who were actually mainly a priestly clan who were supporting or were opposed to the Maccabees having the high priesthood, they were essentially, you know, turned into refugees, and they became a minority group that was agitating against this. And from this movement arose the Qumran community, which in a sense tries to live a temple lifestyle in the wilderness without the temple, but hoping for a return to their authority over the temple and also for God himself to restore the pristine temple and essentially to restore them in power as the priests who are running the temple. So the whole movement of Qumran grew out of a schism over temple authority and what's the proper ritual, who should be in charge, how it should be done. And all of the Dead Sea Scrolls then are intimately connected into this ideology. And specifically the temple scroll details how they think the temple should be, and that's what Andy Skinner talks about in this particular passage. I can't remember the page number. It looks like 3.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah.
The other thing that you'd need to know about in the terms of the Dead Sea Scrolls is they're found starting about 1947, as I recall. Isn't that correct, Bill?
Right, yeah.
They were found by a shepherd boy in caves in this area. It's a very desolate area. They started finding these scrolls coming out. They turned up, I believe, with some people that sold them, and then found out how valuable they were, and then there was a concerted effort to collect them. There were thousands and thousands of fragments. Some of them are very well preserved, such as this temple scroll that they talk about in here. A lot of them are just little bits and pieces that they've spent years and years and years putting together, and only in the last 4 or 5 years, I think, is when they finally got all of them available for everybody to look at. Before that, there was a group of scholars who, you know, they were qualified scholars, but they kind of protected them in the sense that they wanted to be the first to write about them, as I understand that whole controversy.
Right.
But finally, based on some pressure that's come to bear, everything is now available, as I understand it. Films of those, all of those fragments and everything, and there's still work going on, but there has been a lot published, of course, since 1947. And what that shows is some very interesting things. For example, I believe the Isaiah scrolls are the oldest that they ever have ever found. So these actually predate, in a lot of cases, the scrolls that we were used to put together our own Bible. And so they have really, in 1947, you know, along with the Nag Hammadi discovery, as well as some other discoveries that have taken place since, they really pushed back further than had ever been before the documents that were available in, you know, that in terms of Bible documents. And there are books that aren't in the Bible. Of course, there you come back to the whole idea of the canon of the Bible, but there are a lot of parts of the Dead Sea Scrolls that aren't included in the Bible, including, of course, this Temple Scroll.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, so that is a great introduction to what the Dead Sea Scrolls are, where they came from, the peoples that produced them. Basically, as I understand it from you guys, the people basically were the result of a disagreement over temple authority. They believed that the authority had gone apostate, basically, in the temple, and so they fled into the wilderness, so to speak, to establish their own community where they believed they could set up the temple in the proper authoritative way, and as Andrew Skinner gets into here, he makes a point in saying that that these people made a really good, interesting connection between making covenants with God and the temple. Those two things were connected, covenant making and the temple. And I like this sentence where he says, the basic ideal for the covenant makers at Qumran was to live as though they were in the midst of the temple itself every minute of every day. I like that. That's kind of a similar sentiment that modern prophets have often taught the Latter-day Saints to so live.
Yeah, it was an attempt to essentially make sure that everyone in the community was prepared to enter the temple at any moment. And there were a series of both purity laws and also moral laws that you had to obey. And in some ways, these were priestly laws that in far antiquity, the priests were supposed to do this, but the common people didn't necessarily have to do them all. And so what the Qumran community said is, no, we should all live the purity laws and the moral laws of a priest so that we can be prepared to enter the temple whenever it might be possible. And so they essentially created a permanent temple-worthy community, if you want to call it that.
Very interesting. Yeah, absolutely. And so we get into then one of the texts that the Dead Sea Scrolls people wrote, essentially, which was the Temple Scroll. And as Andrew Skinner says here in the book, it was the longest of the scrolls, which is in and of itself an interesting point, that this scroll was so long. And one of the things I thought was interesting was that he said that it purports to record the words of God to Moses. Now, I think that's of interest to Latter-day Saints, solely because we have a book called the Book of Moses, right? I don't know if there are any connections or have any connections been made between the two books, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it reads as a first-hand account where God says, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, whereas in the five books of Moses, it's the Lord said this, the Lord said that. If you read the Temple Scroll, it is, you know, I will do this, I want you to do this, I command you to do this. So it's first person. It's the and it's, you know, not unique, but it's certainly striking in that regard.
Yeah. Do you want to, Bill, could you take us through what Andrew Skinner thought was interesting about the Temple Scroll, what connection he made there in the Temple Scroll that he thought was so fascinating?
Well, he quotes from... let me see if I can make this screen share work. Can you see that?
Yep, we got it.
This is the font big enough, or should I increase the size?
I'd increase the size just a little bit, I think, Bill.
Yeah.
Is that better?
That was better, yep. Yeah,
that's good.
Okay, this is a passage. It's from the Temple Scroll, and these documents are identified by coding numbers that tell you which cave it came from and which scroll it is and which fragment and so forth, which column and which line. And so this is from 11Q, which means the 11th cave of Qumran. They found 11 with scrolls in them. And then it is, fragment or piece 19, and then page 29, and then line and so forth. So that's how they identify them. But at any rate, this is related to Deuteronomy, and basically the Lord is saying, I want you to do these sacrifices. And you'll notice here he says that you're to do them in the temple upon which I shall cause my name to dwell. And that's quoting the book of Deuteronomy, where in chapter 12, where the Lord says, the temple will be the place where I will put my name, the place where my name will dwell, things like that. Repeats that repeatedly there. And then the passage Andrew Skinner talked about was this one down here in 7 through, these are lines 7 through 10. The people will find favor, and they shall be my people, and I will be theirs. That is, this is a promise from the Lord that if the people keep the covenants, they'll be his people, and he will be their God. And again, this is quoting some biblical texts. But this will be forever, and I shall dwell with them for all eternity, meaning that the temple site will no longer be profaned as it had been under the Babylonians and as it was again under Antiochus, and in fact as it would be again under the Romans when they destroyed the temple in 70 AD. But this is a promise that in the true temple, God will dwell in the temple among his people forever or for eternity. And then Skinner quotes this, I shall sanctify my temple with my glory. That means the temple will be a holy place because God's glory or his presence is there. For I will cause my glory to dwell upon it until the day of creation. Now, that doesn't mean the day of ancient creation. It means the day of the final creation, the new heaven and earth talked about in the book of Revelation. When I myself will create the temple, that is, God is going to bring the final perfect temple to Jerusalem. The people won't build it, God will build it. And this again is related to Book of Revelation where it talks about New Jerusalem coming down from heaven. And the New Jerusalem is a temple city where, the 12 gates and everything else associated with that. And then he says, I will establish for myself an everlasting, for everlasting in fulfillment of the covenant that I made with Jacob at Bethel. And this is Genesis 28. So what he's saying is essentially, there has been this apostasy, there has been this loss of the glory of the Lord at the temple, but in the future, this is a prophetic promise that the Lord will, his glory will return to the temple and dwell there, and that will be the fulfillment of the covenant made with Jacob at Bethel. So this is the passage Skinner quoted, and it's basically telling us that of this hope that the Qumran community had for this final, perfect, eternal temple that God himself will build. Not built by human hands is sometimes how it's described, the temple made without hands. That's what they're discussing here.
There's also an interesting connection, though, in terms of the name itself, because Bethel means house of God, or house of the Lord, and Margaret Barker, in her book on the Gate of Heaven, talks about the place, the geographic location of where this took place at Bethel, and at least her perception, and it's in the chapter, page 18, the chapter entitled The House of the Lord, she's talking about the rock, and it turns out to be a very interesting place because purportedly where this took place when Jacob had the vision and he could see the angels going up and down the ladder, which turns out to be what a lot of people call a throne theophany, and is very typical of the various prophets, basically talks about that's also where it became the site of many great events in Israel's history. I'm just reading that. Dust was scraped from its stone to create Adam. This is all traditional and, you know, stories, but Adam, Cain, and Abel offered their sacrifices there. Abraham and Melchizedek met. Abraham came there to offer Isaac as a sacrifice, and Jacob slept there when he saw the ladder which reached up to heaven. The temple was built on a crucial spot, and basically that's where the Dome of the Rock is now, where the temple was built. So it's, in a geographical sense, it also has a lot of connections. I just thought I'd throw that in because it does relate to the place and an existing temple as well as the future temple.
Yeah, that is interesting. For those listeners that are listening in and don't know what Jacob at Bethel is, maybe we could talk a little bit about that. It was a very interesting passage of Scripture in Genesis, chapter 28, where Jacob has a vision of sorts, a dream, wherein he sees basically this. He sees a ladder extending up into heaven, and I have a few different examples here. Here's another one. He sees a ladder extending from the earth up into the heavens, and he sees angels ascending and descending on this ladder, and he sees the Lord at the top, and the Lord basically says to Jacob that he will endow him with a large posterity and land and these great gifts. Can either of you comment on this vision? What is the symbolism here of the ladder?
Well, the ladder probably is just a depiction of what many of the prophets have seen, including Lehi at the first of the Book of Mormon. And sometimes it's characterized, as Joseph Smith did, a pillar of, you know, kind of a column or an entryway into heaven. And I don't know, Bill, whether you've ever taken a look at the original word for the ladder there, but at least I think it communicates there's a passageway into heaven where usually the typical vision, and Isaiah had one, Ezekiel had one, Daniel, John, the Revelator, they all have the same basic experience, and that is that they saw God and then his son, the Son of God, on his next to him, on his right hand. Just quoting from Isaiah or from Genesis 28, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west. Anyway, then what typically happens with these prophets is they come back and explain what's happened here, but it's all related to the temple, because it deals with being able to be admitted into the presence of the Lord. That's really what this is about. And the hosts of heaven, the angels round about, are also very typical of the early temple, that description of what's taking place there. And it's also similar to what happened to the great high priest, or to the high priest, when he would go into the Holy of Holies once a year. And I'm now talking about the original first temple, the Solomon's Temple, kind of that experience.
Yeah,
the passage, I pulled it up here on my accordance program. The passage talks about him dreaming here. Can you see the script okay?
Uh-huh. Yes, that's good.
And then it says there's a ladder that was set up on the earth. Now in Hebrew, this is this term here, sulam, which means not necessarily particularly ladder, but something that allows you to go up to a higher place. So it could be a stairway, it could be a ramp, it could be, you know, it's not a ladder as we conceptualize it. That's a way to translate it, but it's something that allows you to ascend. So there is something that permits ascension that he sees, and then it reaches up into heaven. And then what he is seeing is at the top of the Solam or the ramp or whatever is the heavenly temple, where God appears at the gateway, and then the angels are ascending and descending, and they are performing the priestly functions in the heavenly temple, you know, worshiping God and so forth, but also then coming back down to earth and interacting with humans and then going back up to God. So the Lord is up there, and then he makes a covenant. When essentially Joseph or Jacob sees this, God makes a covenant with him at this, at the gate of the celestial temple. And then when it's over, Jacob's response is down here in 16, the Lord is in this place. It is the house of God. And in Hebrew, that is, where'd it go? That's not lined up there. Sorry. My computer's not working. It is the Beit Elohim, so it's the house of God, and then it's also the gate of heaven, meaning there's a doorway or something that leads into heaven, and by ascending this ramp or ladder or stairway to heaven ideology comes from this, then you're entering into heaven. And so when he sees this, he takes the rock on which he dreamed, he was sleeping and dreaming on this rock, and he pours oil on top of it. He essentially consecrates it, raises it up. It's called a matzebah in Hebrew. And then he makes it, he says, this is the temple now. This rock, just a monument of a theophany, just a standing rock stone. Standing rock can be a temple in that sense. So he is creating a very primordial form of a temple, which is simply a raised stone. And we see this popping up at Sinai, where they raised 12 stones, and at Gilgal, when they crossed the Jordan River, they raised 12 stones. So the raising of a stone is a very nomadic way to make a sacred spot by just marking the theophany by a raised stone.
Right.
You can kind of see that same sort of thing taking place when the prophets build up stone altars. I imagine that also has that same kind of symbolism of raising the stone.
The altar is in the temple was said it had to be of uncut stone, unhewn stone. That is, it had to be rough, native stone, just like the patriarch would have done. They would have just gotten stones, piled them up, created an altar form, had a matzebah standing stone by it, and that would be it. So they wanted the temple to represent this archaic aspect of patriarchal nomadic altars. Which were the prototype for the temple altar.
I think it's also interesting how Jacob, immediately after having this dream, where he basically experiences this covenant that he makes with the Lord, or the Lord made with him in this dream, immediately after he basically says, okay, this, where I'm sitting, where I'm at, this is a temple because of the covenant that was made. And so that again reinforces that connection between covenants and temples.
Right.
It's interesting, if you go to the book that we've been reading, Mary G. Romney apparently implies that the events of Bethel, as we've just gone through, constituted Jacob's endowment, which is kind of an interesting take on that.
I like how he puts here in the book, President Romney, he kind of relates the covenants that he made with the Lord as the rungs on the ladder.
Yes.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, that's a very ancient Christian way of looking at it, too. The monks, John Climacus, famous 6th century monk, wrote a book called The Ladder of Heaven, and he described all the monastic rules. Each rule was a different rung, and as you got the first rule done, then you'd go to the next one. And in fact, one of those illustrations you showed was from his book, the John Climacus book. Yeah,
I think
that is of the monks ascending the ladder.
This one?
No, the next one. I thought. Let me see. Nope.
This one.
Yeah, that one.
Yep.
See, so the it's gone. The devils are pulling the monks off. You can see them hanging there, you know, by the ladder. They're trying to hang on, but yeah, that one right there. So you can see the monks pulling them down devils pulling the monks off the ladder as they're trying to ascend. so this is, each step was a different monastic rule. I think he had, can't remember, 40 of them or something like that. And then it ends with essentially perfection, that you follow all these rules, and at the end you get on the last rung, it's perfection. So it was their way of kind of describing the same type of idea that President Romney was talking about in that talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I could, maybe just read that paragraph about that is described there by President Romney. Jacob not only passed through the gate of heaven, we've just been talking about, which is the temple, it was equated in what we just read to the temple, but by living up to every covenant, he also went all the way in. Of him and his forebears, Abraham and Isaac, the Lord has said, because they did none other things than that which they were commanded, they have entered into their exaltation according to the promises and sit upon thrones and are not angels, but are gods, quoting section 132 of the Doctrine of Covenants. Temples, he says, are to us all what the Bethel was to Jacob.
Yeah. I like this we see this, you know, here we're looking at the symbolism of the rungs of a ladder as kind of this step-by-step progression. And we see this again and again, and I think a lot, I didn't even realize this until I started studying the temple, that it is a heavenly ascent in the truest sense of the word. The temple is the way we make our way back to heaven, and it's an upward progression. And like in this dream that Jacob had, it was rungs on a ladder, but in other places it's like an ascent through three different levels, for example, or a progression through three different separations of rooms into the central part of a building, like, for example, a temple building. Or even I have an example here, which is an interesting one, of the Iyengar temple, which is interesting solely because in this temple they actually have really large footprints imprinted into the ground, progressing from the door of the temple all the way into the very holiest center of the temple. And maybe Bill, you could shed some more light on that one.
Yeah, this is a temple in Syria that's very similar in its broad features to the Solomonic Temple. And the idea here being that the footprints probably represent the footprints left by God as he enters the temple. The other alternative might be that the footprints that the priest is supposed to follow as he comes to God, represented by the image in the temple. But they're very large. They're oversized footprints.
Yeah, you can kind of see those people standing there in the corner of this one.
Yeah, human's foot just in the upper left-hand corner compared to the size of these footprints.
Yeah,
so the general assumption is that they're divine footprints, and so it represents a sign of the presence of God because he's walked through. Yeah, there you go. That's exactly. But you can still see this sometimes in Christian and Muslim sites. If you go to the Church of the Ascension on the Mount of Olives, it's actually the Mosque of the Ascension now. The Muslims are control it, but they'll show you the footprint that Jesus left as he was ascending into heaven, and the Muslims will show you the same thing in the Dome of the Rock. That there's a footprint that where Muhammad stood before he ascended into heaven. So the idea that a prophetic or a divine figure will leave some type of sign, a token of his presence as a footprint, and notice they're always bare feet because you always take off your feet when you enter the temple, and the washing of the feet is a preparation for entry into the temple ceremony. But at any rate, the footprint then becomes kind of a mark or a token of the presence of God.
That's interesting. That is interesting. Do the footprints also kind of connotate this step-by-step progression then as you get closer to God?
It's possible, but in that sample, because they're so huge, it's generally thought that they're the divine, marking the divine presence. But I guess in the sense that probably the priest followed or walked in the footprints or followed the path outlined by these footprints to the presence of God by their image, then they are following God into his presence in that regard. So, you know, I think it's a spin-off from that idea.
Interesting. Huh. Okay. Well, good. Do we want to go on, or do we think that's good for this evening?
I think that's pretty good. Yeah. What do you think?
I'm just thinking that we might just maybe finish up the introduction in the book, just because he then goes on to some things that President Acey, who was, as I recall, the president of the Salt Lake Temple, said that when he was set apart by President Hinckley, that he taught him the importance of the temple and commanded them to speak about temple attendance at all times and in all things and all places that you may be in. And the relationship here, I think, is important to us as individuals. If we're talking about how important the temple was to Jacob, to Abraham, to all of these prophets, not that we're going to go through the same theophany experience necessarily, but the example is that we're all trying to get back into the presence of the Lord, and the temple is the place we go to do that. And so maybe it's very obvious, but maybe it doesn't hurt to say the very obvious, because that's exactly what Skinner does in his book. He said that's what President Acey was told by President Hinckley. So we ought to try to figure that out and just say that's one of the reasons that we need to learn, in my opinion, about the temple, and we need to then go and experience it in that service, as he says, in the service of the Lord. And maybe I could just skip to the what he talks about, the unequivocal truths that were confirmed to Skinner by this talk by President Acey. Number one, the temple is the ultimate place of covenant-making activity. The temple is the ultimate place of learning immortality. And I know that Hugh Nibble used to say, that's the Lord's university. That's where you really go to learn the good stuff. that's where you... And truly, it's characterized as the mysteries. That's where you learn the mysteries of God. The temple is truly where heaven and earth, time and eternity, God and man come together. And then he said, the promises found in the temple are what I crave for myself, my family, and my friends. So maybe that's kind of a way to move us to the next point, which would be in his chapter, because that kind of finishes out out the introduction. And I think that this experience that Jacob had is a marvelous example that is now replicated, if you are looking for those kinds of things, in many other experiences, both the vision of Lehi and Nephi, and as I said earlier, Ezekiel, Daniel, Isaiah, all of them, if you know what you're looking for, had that experience. And another thing is, on the Mount of Transfiguration, if you recall, and I tried to figure what was Peter doing when he built the tabernacles? He's building the temple. You know, it says he built these three tabernacles. And until I got into reading Margaret Barker and really getting into this temple stuff, I thought, you know, I just blew past it. I said, what on earth is he doing? And just like Bill said earlier, that's exactly what you do. if you had an experience like Jacob had, that's that's what you do. Is you build a temple, and in that sense it was a tabernacle, but obviously we know that the tabernacle was the precursor to Solomon's temple.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for that, Gary. That's a great way to kind of finalize, you know, the thoughts of the end of this introduction. He definitely places a lot of emphasis on, you know, the temple, and as a it's a central focus of our worship, really, in the church. It should be the focus. And I like here at the end, he says, you know, it's the place of ultimate blessings and the most important place on earth. Perhaps all of us get caught up at one time or another in the thick of thin things. I really like that. Hopefully, as we get into, you know, studying about the temple and learning more about the blessings that we can receive from temple attendance, we can refocus ourselves on what matters most, and that is basically making our way back to our Heavenly Father.
Yeah, in ancient societies, the essence of the temple was the place where you enter into the presence of God. In Hebrew, they say lipnei Yahweh, which means that you stand before the face of God, the face of Yahweh, the face of the Lord. And so that's the essence in every single culture throughout the world. The temple is the place where you meet God, and that's a core ingredient, the essential ingredient of LDS temples as well.
Yep. Yeah, anciently, you know, the temple was the place of the divine presence. That's where God came to interact with man. That was the connection point, the gate of heaven, the point of entry, and all of that. So, yeah. Well, very good. I certainly appreciate you both for having joined us this evening to have a little discussion about the temple. I think this is valuable. I think it's helpful for us all to learn a little bit more about the temple, its antecedents throughout history, perhaps understand a little bit more what our modern temple tradition is all about, why we go to the temple. And I appreciate you joining us tonight to help us understand a little bit better those things.
It's fun.
Very good. Thanks a lot for putting it together, Bryce.
You're welcome. I hope we can do some more of this.
We'll try it.
All right. Well, we'll sign off for tonight, and we hope to see you again next time.
Okay.
So, very good.
We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.